Hi everybody, this is Peter Laws welcoming you back to the Flicks the Church Forgot. This is the final part in a four-part series exploring the Frankenstein myth. For reviews of the, some key Frankenstein movies, then you can listen to the first two episodes in this series. The latest episode, just gone out, was exploring some readings of what Frankenstein represents, whether or not it's all about a god complex or some sort of homosexual allegory. But in this episode, I'd like to explore what I believe, at least for me, is the real heart of the Frankenstein story.
You are not evil. You are good.
So often people think that evil is somehow inherent in a person, that it's inside them, and like a software program, it will inevitably turn the hardware of that person to do bad things. Just like at the film reports of terrorists or serial killers and the discussion about how they are the most evil people in the world, that they are simply dysfunctional horrors. And yet I think the message of Shelley's book, which can also be seen in the film based on it, in the films based on it, is that in some ways that directly challenges this idea. It says that rather than being inherently bad, a person is driven to bad behavior by social conditioning. In other words, it's nurture, not nature, that really creates the beasts of this world. The creature in Shelley's novel is not the mumbling, shuffling brute of Karloff's version. In the novel, he actually becomes quite articulate. He philosophizes about life. Some say he philosophizes a bit too much about life in the book. And throughout the novel, he keeps making this point in various sections. He says that, you know, people are the product of their surroundings rather than inherently bad or good. And I think this is a fascinating idea. You see, from a Christian point of view, yes, the Bible says that everyone who has ever lived is a sinner in the sense that nobody is morally perfect because we've all fallen short of the high standards of God's glory. In fact, it's silly to think there are people who never do anything or think anything wrong in their lives. The Bible calls these falling short examples sin. It's a religious word, perhaps, but it's one that describes every person on earth and throughout history, certainly including myself, that we've all had selfishness in us and that none of us have reached perfection, that we've all sort of let people down, or indeed ourselves down, and certainly God down. And yet the Bible also says that we are made in the image of God, and so we have an innate potential for goodness as well. Plenty of people demonstrate this, and they don't have to be a Christian to do it. Sometimes I've heard people try to catch me out on my faith, and they say things like, "Hey, I know an atheist who's a really moral person. Ha ha! How does your Christianity cope with that?" And I'm like, "Huh? Why would that be a problem? I never said for a second that to be moral, you need to be Christian." Because everyone, whether they are conscious of it or not, are, in my opinion, created to reflect the image of God. And so it's no surprise that we find wonderful goodness in many people, no matter who they are, Christian or not. So it's a two-sided coin. Humans have an inherent potential for goodness and often will achieve it. But at the same time, each person has perhaps unsurprisingly fallen short of the perfect standard of God, because we all have this inherent selfishness as well. And I think the point Mary Shelley is trying to make is that in this world of human creations, we are all in some ways at the mercy of our surrounding as to what side of those personalities are going to be emphasized in our lives. You know, bring up a child to feel like dirt, smack him around or abuse him for most of his life, and it's not a shock to find they develop a twisted view of the world. Or indeed, have someone live in a country that is constantly bombed or occupied by foreign troops, is it really a surprise if some of them at some point turn radical and want to respond with horrifying force? I'm not making excuses here, of course not, but I'm saying there are reasons why people think the way they do. Shelley's point is a salient one, I think, for our times. In a nutshell, Frankenstein is about how monsters are made. In her book and the films based on it, the thought is literal. The monster is made from body parts. But in some ways, what makes Frankenstein's creature become a monster is not his physical creation. No, it's his treatment by the society around him once he steps out into the world. This is, I think, the lasting tragic power of the Frankenstein story, which I feel is most vividly seen in the two James Whale pictures and to an extent as well in Frankenstein, the True Story. It's like Baron Frankenstein is desperate to have or make a child, but as soon as it displeases him, he wants to dump it. Is it any wonder it's angry and baffled? Actually, on the subject of Frankenstein being the creature's parent, the writer John Sutherland gives a pretty out there suggestion about this. He argues that when Victor Frankenstein claims he has created the monster, quote, by the work of my hands, Sutherland suggests that he was implying that the Baron had to masturbate into a petri dish so that the creature could be fertilized and be given the magic of life itself. Not an image you can imagine being in the Universal version, and quite a flight of imagination based on a few words, but still, the idea that the Baron is desperate to produce life, something new and vital, I think is quite an intriguing one, as if it is an expression of his own life. Like producing a new life makes us feel like we are touching eternity, is so desperate to make life. Maybe that's why so many people are desperate to have children, because we have this idea it will give us some sort of metaphysical longevity, because our DNA will be standing up and crying at our own funeral. So anyway, in Frankenstein, the child is born, and in the 1931 version, the Baron is ecstatic with delight. It's alive! It's alive! But as soon as that child is not what he'd hoped for, or all he could be, as soon as he shows that he might hurt others, he is immediately dropped. I mean, if you watch that first film, it is just heartbreaking how Frankenstein desires this creation with such fervor. He makes this monster with such effort, and then rejects it with such unthinking selfishness. Doesn't want him anymore. It's like in Frankenstein the True Story, where the creature is rejected simply because he starts to look physically unappealing, that there is a flaw in his looks, and that is enough to class him as a monster. You know, it's just it's a reminder of how we can treat people who have some sort of physical deformity. You know, we have this habit in our society of wanting to dismiss that which ceases to please us. Now, some could get into the argument and say that abortion is a good example of a society which thinks it's okay to create life and dump it. But while the Baron tries to abort his creation, I think this story of Frankenstein, for me, is more moving and relevant, or at least it makes me think more, of people who are born but are then rejected. How many children have been born into situations like the creature? You know, produced, as it were, and then rejected. Like the street children of Brazil, like abandoned babies on the nunnery steps, like children kept in families but not shown an ounce of love or affection or discipline or wisdom. Like, is it any wonder that some, and I stress only some, that some of them end up, for want of a better term, like monsters? And by monsters, I don't mean they are actually monsters, but I mean they get labeled as monsters because of the things they might do. How many of the criminals and dysfunctional people of this world have seen the seeds of their choices sown long into their past? I think this is what makes Karloff's portrayal stand so high above the rest. Because he got the sympathetic side to the creature and played him that way. Like a child. Like, just watch his clumsy but earnest hand movements, the slight little smiles here and there when he thinks he's found a friend. And also see how he responds to nurture when it's given to him. The blind hermit who ignores what the creature looks like because he can't see him just connects with him as another lonely person. And you can just see his touching joy at finding another companion and how the creature responds to love with affection and kindness and domesticity. Even the little girl the creature winds up drowning in the first film, it happens by pure accident. The creature just wants to play with her. And one particularly sad touch, they're throwing flowers into the water. These pretty little things. And as the creature looks at the girl, he assumes, well, she's just a flower too, isn't she? She's pretty, she's delicate, she's good. And she's demonstrated that that's what we do with pretty things. And so he picks her up and throws her in the water. But he hasn't actually come to appreciate his own strength, or indeed the law of physics. And there's no one there to teach him otherwise, because his creator has turned away from him. It's such a submersive moment to see a child killer on a film who you sympathize with. Sheesh. Add to this the fact that in The Bride of Frankenstein, we see the creature starting to talk. Now, this was a move that Karloff apparently wasn't happy with at all. He felt you would lose the pathos and vulnerability of the character if he started waffling on, you know, smoke good, boots heavy. Okay, I guess with hindsight, that sort of approach can easily be mocked. But I think Karloff's caution... That sounds like a salad dressing. I think Karloff's caution was unwarranted. The speaking of the creature does, I think, add a new sense of depth to the character. And more than that, it gives a sense of growth. That this character is getting more advanced the more the time goes on. I always thought that really adds to the tragedy of those Universal movies. That this is a creature, if left, could well have developed into a decent, created human being. Even with a criminal's brain, the inherent goodness of him is trying to overcome that. And yet all these jumpy, superstitious people around him cannot bear him because he's different and a little ghoulish. And after all, don't we want to destroy the things we fear? So yeah, for me, the talking in Bride of Frankenstein adds something rather than subtracts. Set against those scenes where the creature responds to love with affection and kindness are all the other moments where the creature is chained to a wooden chair or beaten in a petrified forest. Is it any surprise that once a rejected eventually responds with fury? And it becomes even more poignant at the end of Bride of Frankenstein, where the creature has wandered this world and realized that, no, people are not ready for him. They hate him. And so he grabs the electric switch and he announces, "We belong dead." Man, it's such a profound thing to say. This guy never asked to be raised from the dead. He never asked to be knitted together by this power-hungry, thrill-seeking Baron Frankenstein. And yet being brought into this world, he tries his best and he gets rejected for it. To the extent that he gives up his own life at the end of it, crushed beneath the falling rubble of the edifice in which he was born. That there are parallels with the Jesus story, I don't think is that hard to spot. Particularly when at one point in Bride of Frankenstein, Will has the creature hoisted up on a pole in a pretty stark reminiscence of the crucifixion. And when the character of the creature pulls that switch, it's not thinking, "I'll die now, but hey, I'll be back for the sequel. They're gonna make a sequel, I reckon." No, he dies without any sense of hope. He just gives up when he says, "We belong dead." And why has he lost his hope? Because he got rejected. I think maybe this reason why the story resonates with me so much is because it has echoes with Jesus coming to our world and being ultimately and cruelly rejected. And that even in those moments when he died on the cross, he felt that the Father had abandoned him, just as Baron Frankenstein abandons his creature. Those words of Jesus, right? My God, why have thou forsaken me?" Can't you just see them and hear them on the words and the lips of the creature? As he stumbles towards his creator in the windmill at the end of the first film, "Baron Frankenstein, you created me. You are my God. You wanted to be my God. You said so yourself. And you brought me into this world with so much effort. And now you have broken my heart and ruined my soul. Why have you forsaken me?" I think this is moving because it feels like the sort of thing that Jesus said on the cross when the Father turned his face away from him because of the taking the sins on himself. This pattern of rejection is sadly repeated every day in the lives of those around us. People you know, people you work with, even you, perhaps. Kids at school who feel rejected by their friends, their parents. Wives who discover their husbands are having affairs, or indeed the other way around. Children who are bullied. People who upload a video to YouTube because they want to be a singer and fall prey to the anonymous monsters who sit there tapping out rejection like it's their second language, or in some cases their first. "This bitch is so lame, go and die," you know, that sort of thing. And to expand the analogy of Frankenstein, what type of monstrous society are we creating if the national pastime becomes judging and destroying people on the internet? You can just imagine Frankenstein's monster today sitting in his lonely castle bedroom, flicking through Facebook, clicking on friend, 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 you know, like nobody responding. You know, Jesus knows well what it's like to be rejected by those he loved most, even by his heavenly Father. So he's got a special understanding for those who face rejection and loneliness every day. And I find it deeply poignant to discover that the creature with bolts in his neck, who shuffles around in heavy boots, who says things that we want to laugh at like, "Friend, good," becomes simply another in a long line of people that others turn from and reject. And in that scenario, it becomes hard to work out who the monsters are. Indeed, so often people trying to be clever will make the obvious point. "Hey, you do know, don't you, that Frankenstein in the story, the monster isn't called Frankenstein. That was the name of the doctor, not the creature, not the monster." But in some ways, I wonder if maybe those naive ones have been right all along. Maybe Dr. Frankenstein is the monster. The creature is only his hapless victim. Or maybe they are both monsters, both victims, because after all said and done, isn't that true of any one of us? We have the potential for good and yet can respond so often with selfishness and cruelty to others. Kenneth Branagh did a version of Frankenstein in 1994 and he includes a telling scene in it. The creature's been created and so it starts to wonder, "Is all I amount to is a walking body with instincts and moving eyes? Or am I a person?" With a definition of personhood for many at the time would have had, which was the spiritual dimension. Do I matter, as it were, cosmically, socially? In the scene that I'm mentioning, Robert De Niro is playing the monster and he sits with Frankenstein in an ice cave around a fire. And the creature asks, "What of my soul? Do I have one? Or was that a part you left out?" What if he does have a soul? Like any other human being, what if Frankenstein's creature did or does have a soul, but he's being battered by the relentless rejection of this world has knocked it out of him? You know, where does evil begin? Well, as a Christian, I do believe in the devil, but I'm not about to act as if he is this Cartesian pilot in the brains of bad people making them do bad things. I think the devil probably works a lot more subtly than that, through the selfish way we can treat each other in society. And in the strangest way, I think the story of Frankenstein has become for me yet another sermon lurking in the guise of a horror film. A sermon to me, that I ought to be more charitable and wise with how I treat other people, particularly those who are different from me, particularly those who look different from me, lest I make monsters and in so doing become a monster myself. Well, that's it for the Flicks the Church Forgot. I hope you enjoyed my rather in-depth exploration of Frankensteinian themes. Don't know if that's a word or not, but I just made it a word. I certainly enjoyed working them out. Now, why not follow me on Twitter or hook up at the Facebook page, the Flicks the Church Forgot, or indeed catch my column in the Fortean Times. But until next time, be nice and be a friend. And don't forget, the Flicks the Church Forgot.